You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that having akhlaq, having the best of akhlaq, makes you pleased, happy, and also makes people love you. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, in a hadith, he says, ثَلَاثٌ يُوجِبْنَا الْمَحَبَّةَ. Three things bring about love. It makes people love you. One, حُسْنُ الْخُلُقِ, having the best of morals. Two, he says, وَحُسْنُ الرَّفْقِ, becoming, when you have a partner, you have a companion, you have someone with you, that you become nice and kind to them. And three, وَالتَّوَاضُعُ, being humble in front of people. You know, not having pride and arrogance and trying to look down on people. The opposite to that. Being humble in front of them. Seeing yourself as one of them. You are not better than any of the rest. These three things, which are all akhlaq, so husn al-khuluq and being a kind companion and having humility, these three things makes people love you, brings the love of people, your love into the hearts of people. Again, he says, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, man hasanat khaliqatuh tabat ashratuh, whose akhlaq are good, living with him becomes good. So those who have pure akhlaq and nice and kind, we love to sit with them. We love to be among them. We love to mingle with them. Why? Because of their akhlaq, because they're kind and gentle and nice to be with. And I'm very sure you can think of many people that you've been or you've seen throughout your life that you would love to sit with them and you would love their company because of their akhlaq. There are some people you could never get sick of them in terms of like, I don't want to be with them anymore. Yeah, hardly, because everything about them is good, is kind, they're gentle. So you would want to spend time with them. So the Imam says, man hasanat khaliqatuh, if his akhlaq are good, طابت عشرته, sitting with him, being with him or her becomes such a beautiful thing to do. So brothers and sisters, me and you, we need to come back to our akhlaq, reform it, fix it, try to purify it so people could love us and people could at least sit and talk with us. And thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواه از کف دهن عشق و تولای تو را یا
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Outside Belgium's largest asylum application center, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city center. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the center to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from a long time ago. When you claim asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine.
On the face of it, this might look like a Belgium problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination?
That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence and with our support. They need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 is considered as one of President Biden's biggest failures. The NBC News revealed that the White House and U.S. agencies have started discussions on how to handle the anniversary of withdrawal to prevent further political damage to the president. Afghan experts believe that by reversing the truth, the Biden administration will try to sweep their failures under the carpet and turn a blind eye on the miseries of Afghans whose lives were spoiled by messy withdrawal.
The U.S. and Western propaganda have always had the skill of broadcasting historical events in a way they want. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has not been an exception to this rule. It's clear that the U.S. will whitewash its withdrawal mission in its anniversary to keep their global prestige. While we and the world witnessed the U.S. mess in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as a result of their failure, a political system collapsed, NATO-Afghanistan agreement was broken, and dozens of Afghans were devastated. Most importantly, the U.S. lost its reputation as NATO gendarme.
Shahir, who is in hiding, was left behind by the U.S. He and his family members were asked to come to the airport, but weren't airlifted. He is angry with the U.S., and is still shocked from the sorrowful, frustrating, and insulting evacuation process. He says he feels betrayed by the U.S.
When I made it to the gate of the airport along with my family members, the NATO forces were firing bullets and tear gas everywhere. Inside Kabul airport, we witnessed four Afghans shot dead and three others injured by the U.S. forces. People were panicked, running everywhere. While I was showing my documents, NATO forces hit me with sticks and it started bleeding. Then I gave up as I felt insulted and betrayed by the U.S.
The U.S. 20-year devastating war on Afghanistan ended with a disastrous withdrawal. Several Afghans fell from American aircrafts. Some were shot dead and wounded. Many children were lost. Moreover, a U.S. airstrike hit a house in the airport neighborhoods, killing 10 family members, including women and children. The chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan in 2021 reminds Afghans of those ugly and tragic days. People here blame the ill-prepared U.S. for spoiling the lives of thousands of Afghan people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protesters from Palestine Action Scotland scaling the roof of one of the world's largest arms companies in Glasgow, demanding that the facility be shut down. They're soon arrested by Scottish police, but they've done the damage they intended.
They've obviously realised that asking nicely has not worked. The government hasn't made any lasting change and they have taken measures into their own hands where the government has chosen not to.
The activists, who were taken in court and released later, accused the Paris-headquartered multinational TALS group of making an array of lethal weapons that help enforce the Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. The Watchkeeper drone is one of the group's deadly products, developed in collaboration with a notorious Israeli weapons company that's been the target of these activists for years now.
In 2019, TALIS made €8.3 billion in profit, and that wasn't just off the suffering and oppression of Palestinians. It was from the oppression of refugees worldwide. Their business is oppression, their business is genocide, and they're willing to sacrifice millions upon millions of lives for profit.
The building behind me used to house the headquarters of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. Earlier this year, and after 2 years of relentless direct action, Palestine actions say they forced the company to close down and leave, getting one step closer to ending Israel's arms trade in Britain.
That came only 5 months after the company was forced to close up shop in the northwestern city of Oldham, Greater Manchester. Elbit Systems still has 8 more sites in the UK. Palestine Action say they will continue to throw a spanner in the works of Elbit and companies that collaborate with it, until they're all closed and until Palestine is free. Saeed Puriza, London.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a 2-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
As the race for the leadership of the UK ruling Conservative Party heats up, the fight for who will become Britain's next Prime Minister turns ugly. With bitter exchanges, leaked dodgy dossiers, and attacks on rivals' policies, the contest could quickly turn into a large-scale brawl. A flurry of weekend announcements has put the total count of top job hopefuls at 11, a large number filled with big and small names. Rishi Sunak tops with the most Tory MP supporters so far, with pro-Brexit Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt coming in second. However, critics say a long drawn-out contest will deepen economic uncertainty amid a cost-of-living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly, Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute. And I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. I suppose it's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister, and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. But, you know, I mean, you just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives, and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate, who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Absana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians, It's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The small settlement of Toshkivka, there's so much destruction, it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we passed that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map.
Now, we're on the road to Lyshansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour.
The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it, and there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lysychansk.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity needed with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the governmental institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Trump Sought to Conceal Plans to March to Capitol, panel says. Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The President of the United States is going to have us march there, in the Capitol, Kylie Jane Kremer, an organizer of the Save America rally on 6th of January 2021, wrote in a 4th of January text shown by the panel on Tuesday as it detailed Donald Trump's efforts to gather his backers in Washington for a final last-ditch effort to overturn his election loss. Ms. Kremer added that Donald Trump was going to just call for it unexpectedly. Mr. Trump weighed announcing the move, according to documents obtained from the National Archives, which provided the investigators with a draft tweet that said, I will be making a big speech at 10 a.m. on 6th of January 2021 at the Ellipse, south of the White House. Please arrive early. Massive crowds expected. March to the Capitol afterwards. Stop the steal. The tweet was never sent, but it was the latest evidence presented by the committee of how Donald Trump undertook a public and private effort to channel angry supporters, including right-wing extremists, towards the Capitol building, where Vice President Mike Pence and lawmakers were gathered to confirm Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory as president-elect. For more than a year, Donald Trump and his defenders have described the violence at the Capitol as a freewheeling, peaceful protest gone awry. But the hearing on Tuesday, 12th of July, laid out how the former president took a guiding role, not only in bringing the mob fueled by his election lies to Washington on that day, but also in the plan to direct it up to Capitol Hill, disregarding the advice of his closest aides. Donald Trump summoned the mob to Washington, D.C. and ultimately spurred that mob to wage a violent attack on our democracy, said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the House Committee. In its seventh hearing to lay out its findings, the committee situated Donald Trump at the center of the quasi-legal efforts to derail the political process and also at the heart of the unprecedented chaos at the Capitol. Over nearly 3 hours, it introduced evidence from rally organizers, from rioters and aides inside the White House, who said the former president had inspired and directed what transpired on that day. While it did not draw any direct link between Donald Trump and the domestic extremists who orchestrated and stood at the forefront of the Capitol attack, the House Committee set forth in meticulous detail how Donald Trump's words and actions united a disparate set of far-right groups and militias and spurred them to plot a violent effort to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. The president got everybody riled up and told everybody to head on down, said one of the witnesses at the hearing, Stephen Ayers, an Ohio man who pleaded guilty last month to disorderly conduct charges connected to the Capitol attack. Stephen Ayers added, "We basically were just following what Donald Trump had said." Even Brad Pascoe, Mr. Trump's one-time campaign manager, blamed his former boss for the deadly violence that ensued, according to evidence shown by the committee on Tuesday, 12th of July. "A sitting president asking for civil war. I have lost faith," he wrote in text messages on 6th of January 2021 to Katrina Pearson, Donald Trump's former spokeswoman, adding that Mr. Trump's rhetoric killed someone. Even as it revealed new evidence about Donald Trump's bid to cling on to power, the committee suggested that Mr. Trump was still trying to protect himself. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, and the panel's vice chairwoman, repeated her concerns that Donald Trump had been quietly interfering with the committee's work by discouraging witnesses from cooperating with the inquiry. After the panel's last presentation, she said, "Donald Trump tried to call one of its witnesses, and the witness, through a lawyer, alerted the House Committee. We will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously," Liz Cheney said, adding that the panel had notified the Justice Department about the matter. In a statement on Twitter, Taylor Bodewich, a spokesman for Donald Trump, accused Representative Liz Cheney of spreading innuendos and lies, but did not address whether the former president had tried to contact a witness. In the hearing room on Tuesday, Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, and a member of the House Select Committee, sought to draw a roadmap of Donald Trump's multi-layered effort to overturn his defeat, unfolding in three concentric rings. On the inside ring, Mr. Raskin said, was Donald Trump's pressure campaign against Mike Pence to persuade him to unilaterally throw out electoral votes for Joe Biden as he presided over a joint session of Congress to make the official count. In the middle ring, Jamie Raskin said far-right extremist groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, unleashed by a December 19 tweet from Donald Trump that promised a wild rally in Washington on 6th of January, took the lead in invading and occupying the Capitol. And in the outer ring, he added, a large and angry crowd, encouraged by Donald Trump's lies about election fraud, became a political force that sought to keep the former president in power. The story the committee told on Tuesday, 12th of July, took place over three chaotic weeks at the end of 2020, starting on 14th of December, when the Electoral College met and declared Joe Biden the winner of the election. Within a day, leading Republicans like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky acknowledged Joe Biden's victory, and several aides to Donald Trump, including Pat Cipollone, the top lawyer in the White House, advised the president to concede defeat. Instead, the committee documented how Donald Trump ignored top administration officials and turned his hopes and attention to a group of outside advisers who were recommending a dangerous and unprecedented plan to use the country's national security assets to seize control of voting machines and essentially to rerun the election. Through videotaped testimony, the panel brought to life a heated and often profane meeting in the Oval Office on 18th of December 2020, in which the advisers, among them the lawyer Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's former national security adviser, fought with Pat Cipollone and other White House advisers about the plan to seize the voting machines and to appoint a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Early the next morning, once the meeting ended, Donald Trump posted the message on Twitter, urging his supporters to come to Washington on 6th of January 2021, writing, "Be there, we'll be wild." The response to the message was immediate and electric. It was quickly amplified by prominent Trump supporters with influential followings like Alex Jones, the impresario of the conspiracy-laden media outlet InfoWars, and the right-wing podcaster Tim Pool. In the darkest corners of the internet, Donald Trump's supporters on websites such as thedonald.win soon began discussing bringing handcuffs, body armor, shields, bats, and pepper spray to Washington. Others talked about committing violence. "Why don't we just kill them all?" one person wrote on the chat board, 4chan. "Every last Democrat, down to the last man, last woman, and child." Donald Trump's tweet also had significant effects in the real world. Within days of it being posted, a pro-Trump organizing group called Women for America First changes plans to hold a rally in Washington after Joe Biden's inauguration, moving the event up to 6th of January 2021. Around the same time, the committee showed the prominent Stop the Steal organizer Ali Alexander registered the website wildprotest.com, which provided information about numerous protests in Washington on 6th of January 2021, with event times, places, speakers, and details on transportation. Mr. Alexander sent a text to an associate on 5th of January 2021, saying that he believed Donald Trump was going to order him and his associates to march to the Capitol, the committee showed. On 21st of December 2020, 2 days after Donald Trump's tweet about 6th of January was posted, a group of far-right members of Congress met with the president at the White House to discuss the conservative lawyer John Eastman's theories about pressuring Mike Pence to disrupt the normal workings of the Electoral College and keep Donald Trump in power. The members of Congress at the meeting included Representatives Andy Biggs of Arizona, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gohmert of Texas, and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, the committee said. The committee heard on Tuesday, 12th of July, from another witness, Jason Van Tattenhove, a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers militia, who described the group as a threat to democracy. The leader of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, is one of several members of the group who has been charged with seditious conspiracy in connection with the Capitol attack. And for the first time, the committee heard testimony from a criminal defendant who was at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 and is now facing charges. The defendant, Mr. Iles, told the panel that he had gone to Washington at Donald Trump's direction and marched to the Capitol when the president told him to do so, and would never have gone in the first place had he known that Donald Trump's election fraud claims were false. Iles said that his participation in the riot had ruined his life and that he felt duped and betrayed by Donald Trump. I felt like I had, like, horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time, Mr. Iles said. The biggest thing for me is take the blinders off. Make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late.
One of the good achievements of Sheikh Mohammed Taqi Qumi is this one, that he had a very nice communication with the Sunni heads of Sunni community in the Egypt.
In order to get these different cultures closer to each other, he decided to focus on the main pillars of Islam and forget about differences in branches.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The program The Teacher is about the lives and the works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, jurists, philosophers, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries, cleric, one of the scholars who dedicated his life on establishing dialogue and unity among the Muslim denomination and sects all across the nation of Islam. He is no one but Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Qumi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you this episode. Give us some information about the early life of Muhammad Taqi Qumi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qumi was born in 1289 according to solar calendar. He was born in 1910.
Yes.
He was born in the city of Qom, and he moved to Tehran when he was very young and studied in elementary school and then in high school in Tehran, and he studied in literature. Besides studying in high school and, you know, learning the Arabic language, French language, and English, he studied in Islamic Studies Seminary. And from that moment on, you know, I think that because he learned three languages besides his mother tongue language, that was Farsi or Persian, this mindset was formed,
yes,
in his mind that taqrib is very important for Muslim ummah. That's why when he was 27, he moved to Egypt to actualize this idea that letting Muslims sit beside each other and to have them tolerate each other.
That's right.
And be a friend of each other. So Sheikh Mohammed Taghi Qommi moved to Egypt. And you know, the moment that this idea came to his mind and, you know, was strengthened in his mind was the event that took place in Mecca, that was a Shia follower of Islam.
That's right.
Was killed and was executed by a court in Saudi Arabia because he had vomited in Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
So, because after this event, the political relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia was, you know, cut. And there were many, you know, tensions between Muslim Ummah.
That's right.
Or amongst Muslim Ummah. So that's why Sheikh Mohammed Taghi Qommi moved to Egypt to find a solution for this problem. And this shows that at the age of 27, he had great visions for Muslim Ummah. And this is very important. When you have great visions, you may take great steps.
That's all right.
And he was amongst those people who took great steps for the sake of Islam.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, is it true that it was over there that he was among the founders of Dar al-Taqlib, Bain al-Mazahib al-Islamiyya, and taking part in the sessions with the other leaders of Islamic denominations over there, isn't it?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is, as it is recorded in the history, in cooperation with Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltoud and Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. Actually, at that time, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi, he was the head of the University Al-Azhar, and after him, Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltoud succeeded him in being the head of the University of Al-Azhar, and also in cooperation with Mustafa Abdul Razzaq, who was the president of Egypt at that time. So this is also a very important point.
Okay.
This is also recorded in the history that, based on some narration, he was invited to Egypt by Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi, the head of the University of Al-Azhar, when he realized that this man and this scholar has the tendency of bridging the gaps between the sects. And since the Muslim Ummah at that time was suffering from the conflicts and segregations among themselves, so the head of Al-Azhar University, he was also of this view that this is a good idea to bring all Muslim leader around one table. Why? Because if we spread this ideology of unity among Muslim leader, then from the leaders, it will go down to the followers.
That's right.
So one of the good achievement of Sheikh Mohammed Taghi Qommi is this one, that he had a very nice communication with the Sunni heads of actually Sunni community in the Egypt.
And was it his introduction out of the Shia and Jafari school of thought to our Sunni brother in Al-Azhar that made it official over there? I mean, because of his efforts and his presence. Because for sure, from our Sunni brethren needed some clarifications and explanations, isn't it? And the best people in order to do so are the Muslim Shia scholars. Mohammed Taghi Qommi for sure was one of them, isn't it?
He was given the chair to teach in Al-Azhar University.
Oh.
And this is interesting that at the moment he was given this chance, and this is also narrated that he was not much confident upon talking about the issue of unity with the vice chancellor of the Al-Azhar University. Because, you know, if you are invited somewhere as a visiting professor, so you have to be conservative as much as you can. Why? Because you don't want to lose this opportunity. But for the sake of Islam, for the sake of unity, he talked, as it is narrated in his biography, that the moment I was talking to the head of Al-Azhar and I was bringing up the issue of unity among Muslim sects, I was really nervous. I was not sure if he is going to welcome this view. But interestingly, he welcomed this view, and we see the fruit of this communication is that the moment he was teaching in Al-Azhar, he benefited from that position to establish or to start publishing the journal Al-Islam.
Risalatul Islam.
Yes, Risalatul Islam.
That's right.
And When he comes back to Iran, he talks to Ayatollah Burujerdi, the head of Shia in the world of Islam, and he tells everything about his communication with the leaders of Sunnis in Egypt, and Ayatollah Burujerdi welcomes him with the open arms. And he himself, Ayatollah Burujerdi, he compiles, maybe the thing was ready at that moment, but he compiles an article on the Hadith Ghadir based on Sunni sources.
Yes.
And then this article will be published in where? In Risalatul Islam,
that's right,
the journal that Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qumi founded in Al-Azhar.
That's right.
So from the position that he received in Al-Azhar.
Okay.
So he was trying really hard,
that's right,
to establish this unity among Muslim sects in Islam.
That's right. Thank you very much. Sheikh Ziya, so when we get to the Journal of Risalatul Islam, we could see that on different articles, he's explaining his methodology of establishing dialogue among different denominations and sects. Because you give us some of the practical thoughts of Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qumi in order to reach such a goal. What are they?
First of all, we should know that he was believing that for establishment of united Ummah of Islam, there is no way but uniting the culture of Muslim communities and Muslim, you know,
I mean, a kind of cultural unity has to be established,
yes,
okay?
And this cultural unity cannot be achieved unless you have dialogue and relationships. So in order to get these, you know, different cultures closer to each other, he decided to focus on the main pillars of Islam and forget about and overlooking about the differences in branches.
Yes.
So that's why he says that we need to have cultural unity in order to unite Muslim Ummah regarding the tenets of faith and to forget about the differences that led or direct us toward takfir and, you know, blaming each other.
Yes, very good.
So he believes that Muslim Ummah would not suffer from differences, but Muslim Ummah would suffer from cutting the relationships because of the differences.
Okay.
So he was not in position to reject the differences, but he was in the position of letting people be aware of the differences and also, beside this, be aware of the common points.
That's right.
So that's why he says that Muslims, all, they accept that we have to act in accordance of the sayings of the Holy Prophet.
Right.
So, because we all are agreed on this point, so let us follow it. And we all believe that we have to follow the orders of the Holy Prophet. Some Muslims, they add descendants of the Holy Prophet. Some Muslims, they add the companions of the Holy Prophet. He says, okay, but the Holy Prophet is the pillar.
The pillar.
So
that's
let
right.
us gather around this pillar.
Access, that's right.
And to get benefit from this main pillar.
That's right.
And yeah, you are believing in different, you know, ideas, it's respectful, but let others be aware of your reasons, of your reasoning, not blame them because of their beliefs. So that's the way
that's right.
that he was believing and, you know, also broadcasting his mindset amongst Muslim Ummah. Alhamdulillah, he was successful.
Alhamdulillah, he was successful and his method was really, I think, practical, a man of action. Okay, anything missed, Sheikh Mahtavi?
I think for the final point, I would like to narrate one of his nice saying regarding the unity among Muslim Ummah. He is saying that if we look at two words, Shia and Sunni, and we give more thought to realize where these two words are coming from and what is the literal meaning of these two words, we will find all Muslims as both Shia and Sunni. How? Because what is the meaning of Shia? Shia means the follower. We have in the Quran in Surah Safat, verse 83, وَإِنَّ مِنْ شِيَتَهِ لَإِبْرَاهِيمِ, we have this word. So he's saying that since all Muslims are loving the progeny of Prophet, you cannot find any Muslim in the west of the world or in the east of the world who does not love the progeny of Prophet. So all of them, they are loving the progeny of the Prophet. So they are following the progeny of
the
Prophet.
They are the Shia, in fact.
So yes, so they are Shia.
Okay.
And when we look at all Muslims in terms of action, we see that they are following also the tradition and sunnah
of the Prophet.
So whether or not we are Shia or Sunni, both titles will be applied upon us. Why? Mm-hmm. Because we are loving the progeny of the Prophet and we are acting upon the sunnah of the Prophet. So why we should fight with each other? Why we should only talk or give focus on the differences which will lead to the segregation and actually separation among us?
That's all right. Really, really beautiful sentence from his side. You know,
may God bless him. Yeah.
Yes, there are Muslims all around the world, are both Shias and the Sunnis, following the Prophet and the prophetic lifestyle and the progeny, and also acting according to the
Sunnah
of the Prophet. Really great, I think, as Sheikh said, mindset from both brothers. I mean, from our Sunni brethren on that time at Azhar University, and from a Shia brothers like Muhammad Taqi Qumi in Iran. Yes, 1990, according to the Christian calendar, is the year that this outstanding man passed away in Paris, in France. Of course, there are different, you know, stories and news about his death. Some people might say that he was killed or assassinated. Yes, assassinated or killed. This is not exactly clear. But he was buried, according to his last will and testament, in Imamzade Abdullah in Tehran, today's Shahr Rey. May Allah bless his soul. The late Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qumi, one of the founders of Darut Taqrib Bainul Mazahib al-Islamiyah in Egypt, really an outstanding man who dedicated his life to the proximity between religions and Islamic denominations. Sheikh Ma'tawi, thank you very much. And Sheikh Siyaniya.
You're most welcome.
It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Iyan Call of Islam page. Also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.